Could you give me a little bit more information about your family's reaction to your choice?
As I recall, I spoke now and then to my parents about, you know, wishing I didn't have to go to college, but knowing that otherwise I would be drafted. And I know that my mother was very concerned about that because my brother had been drafted. My dad had a stroke when I was 17. So, you know, at least in those years before I went to UC Davis, there probably wasn't much from my father because it was almost impossible for him to talk. But I thought I'd read this thing that he wrote. He was in on a battleship in World War II, and he was a very, you know, a very real sensitive kind of person. He was 4F for part of the war, at first in the war, and then was able to enlist in the Navy and was a Lieutenant JG on a battleship. So he wrote this, and it's dated 7 August 1945 at sea. We've just received sketchy, flagrantly boastful news of the new atomic bomb. The superlatives that are used in describing it seem, when we think about the little we know of its nature, to be either inadequate as anachronisms or typically boastfully exaggerated. If the former, I am terrified. Man needs to break the bonds of his soul and release its power long before he should be permitted to break the atom and exploit its power. They say the power can be creatively used, but I fear its original destructive use might be the prophetic. Tyrants, oppressors have had their Cossacks, police, Gestapo. Now what have they got? Incidentally, I wonder what will become of the soul of the hero when his body, instead of rotting or burning, is vaporized in death. The question would trouble the Egyptians more than the capitalists. So that was kind of who my father was, I think, in a way. And my mother was kind of the typical motherly response was, do what you have to do to avoid being drafted. And if you get drafted, the likelihood is that you will probably do well on tests just as your brother did and probably not have to go to Vietnam. But of course, my perspective on that was, yeah, but we don't know that. I remember my brother had gotten back from the Army then. He had gotten back in 1968. So, you know, he wasn't opposed to what I chose at all. In fact, he was supportive of it, but he chose something different and he would counsel me to choose something different. So then after I got through to the point where the decision was made for me, I was drafted and I had to do something. None of the people that I hung out with were at all opposed to my choice.
You know, everybody that I worked with knew that you were in prison and why you were in prison. And I don't remember reactions one way or the other from the people I worked with.
And I think a lot of it was like people would rather not think about it.
Yeah.
People would rather not deal with it.
And by that time, my dad had come around to the belief that Fred was doing the right thing. Before that, he would not have accepted that.
Yeah. After I'd gotten convicted and after I had realized I was going to have to go to jail, and I remember telling him that time's come, he says, well, you know, you dance, you got to pay the piper. I remember saying that real clearly. Saying, yep, I guess you're right.
And of course, both my brothers had already been to Vietnam and came home. So that's a whole nother story. But I was so happy when I heard that Fred had refused induction and I wouldn't have to think about him going over there, because that was a terrible time for me when my brothers were gone and worrying about what they were doing and if they were okay and would I ever see them again. So,
you know, I was around both Mike and Tim a lot more than around my family.
Well, that's
because
true.
I was being around with you and they're being the same age, and mm-hmm. And both of them were completely supportive of my having refused induction from the first they knew about it. Both of them had been to Vietnam. Both of them had seen a whole lot of crap. And both of them just thought it was a perfectly fine thing for me to do and a smart thing for me to do, actually. So let's see what happened. When I got out, I had to come home and report to a parole and probation officer. And then I had to do 18 months of community service. I was a maintenance man for the halfway house in town. And Cindy got pregnant within 2 months of when I got home. We wanted a baby. And so just before she gave birth, the guy said, listen, I'm not going to hold you to this anymore. Your wife's pregnant. You need to go get a job. You're done. And so I ended up doing, you know, 4.5 months in prison and about a year, I think, of community service. And, I mean, the community service part was really pretty straightforward. It was, you know, not a whole lot different from just living life and
regular old job
or whatever. And we were living in a place in Sacramento, downtown Sacramento, and we had moved into this little house that was about the size of a railroad car. It was just this, you know, what they call a shotgun shack, where, you know, it's just had a front room and a middle bedroom and a kitchen with just a kind of a hallway down the side and a bathroom off of one side. And the guy that lived in the very front house was pretty much the same age as me. And his father, his family owned this box making company where they made boxes. So this guy's a good friend. We know each other really well. A job came up in his factory, his dad's factory. And so I get a job in the factory, union wages, making decent money. And it was hard work, and it was kind of strange work, but you know, it was a good job, and you know, here I am, a felon, and all of these things, all of these horror stories about what's gonna happen to you when you get out. You won't be able to get a job. You won't be able to do this, that, or the other thing. It's gonna be a problem. But you know, the transition's kind of seamless, and got a little bit of money saved up, and when Josh was, our son was 18 months old, we moved up to Oregon and started building this house, built a house by hand up there in the Coast Range. And at that time, in terms of work, the work that was to be had was things like tree planting or cutting down all the remaining trees that weren't of any value once they'd logged an area, those kinds of things. And Oregon is always a kind of a depressed area, regularly goes through these depressed cycles. And so there was some federal money available at the time for job training and those kinds of things. And so I got a couple of jobs with state forestry after a while to cut timber or clear brush or fight forest fires. And they paid okay. But, I mean, we lived up there in tents, built this house with hand tools, and didn't need a lot of money. Everything was paid for, and so it was, you know, enough money to buy gas and food and whatnot. So we pretty much just kind of got by until I went to work for the city of Newport, I guess. And that was a CETA job. So that was one of those government jobs, and they didn't care who you were or what kind of record you had. If you had some experience doing different kinds
of things. Were there questions on the application? About
I don't recall.
Were you a felon, or have you ever been arrested?
A lot of times there are questions like that, but I really don't even recall if there was a question
or how
I answered it. When Jimmy Carter became president, one of the first things he did was grant amnesty to everyone who went to Canada and pardoned everyone who went to prison. So from that point on, I just kind of figured I'm not a felon anymore. And so whenever I would answer the question, I'd just say no. I always joke with people that I've been rehabilitated by my prison experience, because they basically trained me how to be a surveyor. And so I was looking for work. Josh was, what, 3.5? Caleb was...
months old.
Caleb was months old. So I was looking for work. I needed work. So I would go down to the employment office, and there was this job that was there that was a surveyor. And I kept thinking, you know, some local guy is going to get this job. Now, I don't have a chance in hell. But it just stayed there on the board. And so finally I applied, and we just talked over, you know, my experience working for the Bureau of Public Roads. And I didn't bother to tell him it was a prison job. I just told him I worked for the Bureau of Public Roads. And he hired me. And so I got this job as a rodman chainman. And from that, then after about 3 years there, I think they said, okay, now you're city engineer. So I became the city engineer. And over the years have worked my way to a senior planner and now to the manager of the planning division in the city of Corvallis. And so all of that started as my being hired as a rodman chainman in federal prison. I was trained by the federal prison, and I am doing the job ultimately that I was trained for. So, so yeah, I guess really the bottom line is that as a result of having refused induction and having gone to federal prison and being a felon, really probably didn't change my life much in terms of you'll never be able to get a job, you'll be a felon, all of those things. It never worked out that way at all for me. You know, in terms of the value of having done that and not of having been to Vietnam or whatever I might have been through in the military, you know, I think in that sense, it's to me, it's all positive. I mean, the whole decision had its tough points, had its hard things to do and all the rest of it. But, you know, in all reality, I know for a fact it was easier than it would have been for me to go in the military, no matter what route that ended up being.